As the Gospel of Mark describes the scene, Jesus is standing in the temple courtyard with his disciples. Dazzled by the architectural majesty surrounding them, one of the disciples blurts out, "Look, teacher, what large stones and what large buildings!" According to the first century historian, Josephus, the Jerusalem temple of Jesus' day was an awe-inspiring wonder. As constructed by Herod the Great, the temple's walls were composed of stones 40 feet long. The temple occupied a platform twice as large as the Roman Forum and four times as large as the Athenian Acropolis. Herod reportedly used so much gold to cover the outside walls that anyone who gazed at them in bright sunlight risked blinding themselves. Throughout Jesus' life, the temple was continually being rebuilt and improved in a seemingly endless construction project. Tragically, it was only just finished before being destroyed by the Romans in the year 70. It would never be rebuilt. 40 years prior to the outcome, Jesus' disciple is impressed with what he sees and tries to share his sense of awe with Jesus. But Jesus isn't dazzled. He sees something else entirely. Our reading is taken from Mark chapter 13, verses 1 to 8. As Jesus left the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, look at that stonework, those buildings." Jesus responded, "Do you see these enormous buildings? Not even one stone will be left upon another. All will be demolished." Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives across from the temple. Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will these things happen? What sign will show that all these things are about to come to an end?" Jesus said, "Watch out that no one deceives you. Many people will come in my name, saying, 'I'm the one.' They will deceive many people. When you hear of wars and reports of wars, don't be alarmed. These things must happen, but this isn't the end yet. Nations and kingdoms will fight against each other, and there will be earthquakes and famines in all sorts of places. This is but the beginning of the birth pangs." In this reading, we hear God's voice. God is still speaking. Thanks be to God.
Donald Schmidt is the minister of First United Church in Kelowna, BC. And he's just published a book that's aimed at, get this, reclaiming apocalyptic texts in the Bible for today's progressive person of faith. His book, Revelation for Progressive Christians, is a response to the fact that apocalyptic texts like the book of Revelation and various texts in the Gospels, like the one we've read today, have been weaponized by fundamentalist Christians, particularly in the United States. We need to take back these writings, Donald Schmidt states. They are for Christians who are simply struggling with how to live day by day, which is what most people are struggling with today. It's not about the end of the world. Revelation almost never mentions the end of the world, and never once mentions the Antichrist. All these things that people say are in there aren't. These texts are about what's happening right now in a troubled and troubling world like ours. That said, apocalyptic writings are weird. They're a genre unto themselves in the literature of most cultures and faith traditions. They emerge in times of distress, and they reflect both despair over what's happening in the world and hope. Hope that something new will emerge. Mark's gospel, the first written story of the life of Jesus, was written shortly after Herod's temple in Jerusalem, the focus of such amazement in today's reading, was destroyed. This came near the start of a catastrophic series of Jewish-Roman wars that resulted, by the time they ended in the year 135, in as many as 2 million dead on both sides, mostly civilians. A generation earlier, before that, Jesus and others could already see that the conflict between the Jewish people and the Roman Empire was going to erupt, and that the outcome would be near annihilation. Reading Mark in this context, we're reminded that apocalyptic literature is at its core protest literature, a protest against the slaughter of thousands on thousands in the year 70 to end a rebellion, which it failed to do. So what Jesus' words address in Mark is the very real and horrific recent past for Mark's readers, not some terrifying future cataclysm still to come. So the disciples' words, marveling at the grandeur and the seeming indestructibility of the temple, are darkly ironic. Mark's readers know that this is an illusion, a false promise of stability. The temple, the center of everything, worship, culture, salvation, tradition, the power grid of a people, and the holy dwelling place of God was gone, just gone. Apocalypse, although the word is associated with the sun going dark and stars falling from the sky, earthquakes and fire and destruction, literally means unveiling, the lifting of the veil, the opening of the curtain, a revealing, revelation, truth with a capital T at long last. As Mark writes, the world that early Christians had known was crumbling. Jerusalem was destroyed. Early church leaders like Peter and Paul were gone. The church was in the middle of its defining break from Judaism. False teachers were confusing people. Fake messiahs with empty promises. And Roman legions continued on the march, spreading death and destruction. The future appears bleak. All seems lost, and people are wondering if there is to be any word of hope for them. I've seen the nations rise and fall, Leonard Cohen writes in his song, The Future. I've seen the nations rise and fall. I've heard their stories, heard them all. But love's the only engine of survival. Into this mix of fear and emotion, Jesus says to the disciples, this is the beginning. This is the beginning of birth pangs. These wars and rumors of wars, the lies and fake news, along with the persecution there that you're experiencing, they're but signs that something is about to happen. Don't worry about the timing. The timing is not yet. No, these are labor pains that precede birth. Mark's community is experiencing suffering and upheaval. There's religious and political persecution, but they're told not to be anxious. This is not the end. It's the beginning. It's the beginning of the birth of something new. For such a time as this. Is it a stretch? Is it too much to suggest that it's no accident somehow that we've been born in these times? That we find our lives unfolding now with our particular histories and gifts, our brokenness, our experience, our wisdom? To consider the fate of our world in this day is to recognize its precariousness. The grand edifices of technology and the feats of science are fragile temples, despite appearances. There are no guarantees of the future. Perhaps, yes, it is a question of our own critical choices regarding the environment, populist politics and economics, but the false prophets are legion, and they confuse and mislead. The week before the U.S. midterm elections, the author and theologian Diana Butler Bass sent out on Twitter a photo of a billboard showing Donald Trump on stage with a banner in red saying, "The Word became flesh," opening words from the Gospel of John. With the slogan in the top right of the billboard, "Make the gospel great again." "Not photoshopped," a stunned Butler Bass wrote. "This is real." "Don't be led astray," Jesus says. "Don't be led astray by false prophets, by reports and rumors. Don't panic. Beware of false gospels and fake saviors. We can be led astray by teachers and theologies that pervert the gospel's message of liberation and grace, undermining it with ideologies, reckless militarist fist-pumping, and political populism. But an apocalypse is an unveiling. To experience an apocalypse is to experience fresh sight. Real, not fake. What Jesus offers his disciples is this apocalyptic vision. He invites us to look beyond the grandeur of the temple and recognize that God will not be domesticated. The temple, the cathedral, is not the epicenter of God's life. God is not bound by mortar and stone. God is beyond every edifice, beyond every institution, every mission statement, every strategic plan, every symbol human beings create in God's name. In her book, God in Pain, Barbara Brown Taylor argues that disillusionment is essential to Christian faith. She writes, "Disillusionment is literally the loss of an illusion about ourselves, about the world, about God. And while it's almost always a painful thing, it is never a bad thing to lose the lies we've mistaken for truth." At times like this, things are being uncovered. The lies and illusions that we've been seduced or misled into mistaking for truth, on which we have pinned our hopes on, can be seen through if we dare. There is truth, and it can set us free. Jesus teaches his disciples what to do and how to live when walls come tumbling down. Contrary to what our hyper, overexcited culture may incite at such times, Jesus insists on a calm strength and a generous love. "Don't be alarmed," he says, when truth is shaken and nations make war, and imposters preach alluring gospels of fear and resentment and hatred of the other. Don't give in to terror. Don't despair. Don't capitalize on the chaos. God is not where people often say God is. God doesn't fearmonger. God doesn't incite suspicion. God doesn't sow seeds of dread. For many of us, these are emotionally and spiritually exhausting times. It feels like stones are tumbling down around us. Massive wildfires are burning in California and BC and in the Amazon. Glaciers melt and ice shelves the size of countries tumble into the ocean. Families mourn in the aftermath of yet another mass shooting in Mexico or California. People starve in the shadows of Yemen's relentless war, or recover from typhoon damage in the Philippines, or suffer racial or sexual violence in India or in our schools, or attempt to cross treacherous seas or hostile national borders because the horrors they leave behind are worse than the dangers that lie ahead. I think Donald Schmidt in Kelowna is on to something important. People of progressive, thoughtful faith need to find a way of talking about these things because it's tempting to despair or to grow numb or to let exhaustion win. But it's now, when the world around us feels precarious and at risk, that we need to respond with resilience, with healing, with love. It's now when systems begin to crack and hard-won values seem to dissipate on the wind that we have to hold each other tight as the veil lifts and we can see what's really going on, what's happening. Jesus assures us what's happening is not death, but birth. Something is struggling to be born. The birth pangs hurt. They hurt incredibly. But God is our midwife, and what God births will never lead to death. These birth pangs will end in joy, in new life. I do believe that. Amen.